they appeal to the executive branch. They appeal to the executive branch and say that they should encourage, first of all, to examine policies from moral perspective. What are the moral basis for each policy of the institution? And I think that the church could do a lot with church standards. What are the moral reasons? When our young people ask question, why? That is a compliment. That means they think. And then we can say, it is for this and for that reason. Because Bible gives those things. So they suggest that that executives should encourage examination of policy and practice from moral stance. Secondly, they said that it is very important that we make difference between moral issues and amoral issues. Issues that don't deal with morality. See, whether I'm going to wear this color of a tie or not depends what my wife feels. But it's not a moral issue. Because she knows the colors and she says, I'm winter and I have to wear winter colors even in summer. But that is amoral. That's not the question of morality. So that's another thing. So they say we would like to know, when is a moral issue? What makes an issue moral issue? I remember in one context where a very high-powered committee discussed a very controversial, not solved yet issue in Adventist Church, chaired by General Conference President, and there were people saying on this side, it's immoral if we don't do it, and on this side, it's immoral if we do it. And they were discussing for almost 1 hour. And Chair looked at me and says, Miroslav, they're talking morality. What do you have to say? Put me on the spot. And I said, well, I first would like to ask them, what is a moral issue? When is an issue a moral issue? And there was silence for half an hour. Not really that long. But it was strange silence. You know, there is another problem very often present, is that we throw morality. You know, that's the ultimate accusation. See, without really knowing what we are talking about. So then I took a few minutes to explain what morality is. Now another thing that they say is that it would be good for managers to understand where the company is going. And even for workers. It's very interesting because one person says we should treat our co-workers at least as well as Balaam treated his donkey. Because the donkey was taking him somewhere and he asked some questions. And he behaved towards donkey in certain way and donkey asked some questions. He was whipping it and he says, why do you hit me? So a certain amount of dissent, they feel, freedom of exchange of opinions would be very good. And finally, they said that it would be good to organize some educational sessions in morality so that they feel more comfortable. All right, capital B, leadership. Leadership. Morality traditionally claimed that every leader should have three personal virtues, three personal moral habits. That's what virtue is. It's a moral habit. Three of them: industry, honesty, and integrity. Every person leading must be industrious, honest, and person of integrity. However, personal virtues are not sufficient in the marketplace. Because there are not only personal sins, there are social sins. And business deals with all kinds of complicated issues. Let me just illustrate one social sin. The Nestle Corporation wanted to gain a little bit more control of South American market. And they wanted to sell baby formulas. Well, they tried in conventional manner, it didn't work. So they decided they are going to show a typical American woman who is not breastfeeding the baby how American woman looks because of not feeding the baby. And putting the sign on big billboard, buy the baby formula and look like American woman. Well, some of the more vain mothers in South America did it. But not enough. So there was another strategy devised. It looked very nice, very, very generous, very beautiful. Nestle Corporation decided, that happened in the 1970s, decided that for every newborn baby, the mother will receive for free 4 weeks worth of baby formula. Wasn't that nice? No. It was very mean. Because in 4 weeks, mother's milk dries up and the mother is continuing bound to buy the baby formula. Now, you talk to the CEO and says, no, I do my job. I'm an honest person. I didn't make that decision. Well, who did it? You go to top manager, well, I didn't do it. To vice president, I didn't do it. To directors of the departments, I didn't do it. Well, who did it? Well, majority vote. So who is guilty? Majority is guilty. Well, how do you find majority? Well, CEO is only chairing. See? So everybody can on personal level look just fine. But when you are dealing with all kinds of things, it's very difficult. Besides, let me just mention this also. Moral issues are very often very difficult because they face us, we face them after certain history has already happened. For example, 8-year-old girl pregnant. What do? You see, it comes when she is already pregnant. Now, it's a fact that she cannot carry that baby to maturity. No way. Both will die. So what do you do? Ellen White says, in one place, I did not find it anywhere else. I found it in one place. I don't remember the quotation. But she says, talking about some issue in a hospital in Battle Creek, she says, sometimes you must choose lesser evil. And then it is our responsibility to choose lesser evil. Now, personal virtues are all right. We must be very careful that we be right. But when it comes to serving the public and to serve in a public arena, then there are other things. And Barbara Andolson, in an article in Annual of Society of Christian Ethics in 1988, says that what is needed is public spiritedness. That is, she defines public spiritedness as the art of acting in concert with others for the common good. The art of acting in concert with others for the common good. That the leader should be capable of cooperating with others. And she mentioned mentions on the objective side two important factors. Objectively speaking, if I have developed this art of cooperating with others, I will remember, first of all, that I must not serve only stockholders. I should also serve the stakeholders. Now, stockholders are people who support, people who invest. And there is duty towards them. But stakeholders are people in community, are their children, their spouses. And stakeholders also should be related to. Secondly, she says, the leader is going to care not only for contract, but also for covenant relationships. With stockholders, there is a contract relationship. With stakeholders, it is a covenant. Contract with stakeholders is covenant relationship. That is, they expect, it is not written, but it is something that should happen. It is more on moral level than on legal level. But she stresses more the subjective aspect. And she says that first of all, we must make distinction between the leaders and managers. I heard a distinction once which says that a manager says, get ready, aim, and he never says shoot. Managers are always getting ready and aiming and applying policy. And that is constant job of managers, typical managers. The leader is different. The leader first say shoot, then he says aim, and then get ready. That is, leader is thinking ahead. Leader is planning. Leader is facing uncertainties. Leader has a vision where things should go. A German word for leadership is beautiful. It is vorlaufen, which means literally running ahead of yourself. When you lead, you run ahead of yourself. I will always kick myself until Christ's coming, because I saw something in when I was doing my studies at Cologne. I worked as night watchman in Geneva, Switzerland, and I would be going to the bank offices and in one president's office of a bank, I saw a statement framed in French. And it defines the job of a leader in a beautiful way. I'll try to translate it in the right way. A leader says, if I want them not to die, if I want them not to die, I must sit up. If I want them to sit up, I must stand up. If I want them to stand up, I must walk. If I want them to walk, I must run. Because if I start walking, they will stop. If I stand still, they will sit down. If I sit down, they're going to lay down. If I lay down, they will die. Leader is always step ahead. Step ahead. Now, There are, according to Barbara, there are two additional virtues that are important. One is prudence. Prudence means being true to the past, being open to the present, and being ready for the unexpected. First of all, being true to the past. I have seen some leaders coming to the office and first 4 or 5 weeks, your head spins. Everything is changed immediately. I remember reading somewhere that one of the American presidents, I think it's Lincoln, said when he came to the office and he was asked, what is he going to change? He said, what is not absolutely necessary to change, it's necessary to leave unchanged for now. Because the workers like and need and are entitled to some kind of stability. So, and it is also good to remember that the past was not always bad. You know, there is some kind of attraction for customers, for consumers, to know, hey, this is a long family business. You know, there is a loyalty in it. There are certain virtues immediately assumed. But a leader must be open to the present, not starting business repairing typewriters. That wouldn't work. No. There are other things. So the leader must know what's what and what's now and what was past. And then being ready for the unexpected. All right, that's prudence. Second virtue that Barbara underlines is courage. And courage has two aspects. The passive mode of courage. That is when we must endure certain things. It is courageous not to react quickly. And that is valid for every aspect of life. When I know that my wife is wrong, and I could prove it in 3 or 4 words, to be quiet is courageous. Try it. It's safe. Experience speaks. But endurance, stamina, resilience. I remember one of our professors was that way. We get engaged in a discussion and so on, and he is quick and he answers quickly, but then all of a sudden we challenge him, and then he's quiet and just walks. And he had a habit of chewing on his lips. And then he stops, and then we know pearl is going to come out. But we sometimes think that it's glorious when we are quick. Usually it's not good. Being courageous to wait. But there is also active mode of courage, and that is attacking the problems when they should be attacked. Rather than passing the buck. Or bureaucratic approach. There is a problem. What shall we do? Let's change the policy. Rather than really dealing with the issue. I remember at Cologne, I was a student. And there is a chapel. Here is the building for the classes. And about maybe 70, 80 feet, 100 feet above is the chapel. And there is a path around it. Oh, students don't walk on the path around. They walk up even when it's covered with snow. Very steep hill. But they destroy the grass. So our administrative council, what shall we do? Well, we should be careful and maybe somebody watching there who is walking and so on. Well, we try that, but when you have about 300 students going to the chapel, You are not even heard. So what they decide is, right where the path is, to put the stairs. They spend a lot of money putting the stairs. Very few walk on those stairs. They walk beside the stairs. See? So, confronting the issue, rather than skirting the issue, and so on. Well, a new president came and he started dealing with this. But in this question of courage, the author suggests that we must be very careful, because courage sometimes becomes commanding, demanding. And she tells us that the two ancient Greek states are a very good example. Sparta was a military state. Things were accomplished there because everything was done on a basis of military. Every male, free male in Sparta was a soldier. So if something needed to be done, his officer would make an order and things will be done. But the population by itself had no initiative. It was morals and indifferent. And unless something was ordered to be done, it was not done. Athens was different. Athens used rhetorics as leadership, which is translated as persuasion. Persuasion. And what she suggests is that when a leader has a vision in mind, the best approach is to share little by little the idea. Take 3 months for it to develop. And then ask for advice. Ask for advice. Even though the leader knows how he will get there or she, it's wise to ask the question. And then add also his or her suggestions and so on, so that the co-workers own the idea. Then they are motivated to do it. This is how Athens did it. So it takes courage to combine the two now. To confront the fact that I have to lead, we cannot wait, but on the other hand, I will be patient. Rather than giving orders, persuasion, time to convince people so that the people would move. All right. Now, we go to third page, religious commitment. How are we going to do that? Well, in the words of the CEO of Ameritech in 1984, when Ameritech was just 6 months old institution, William L. Weiss says the following: I know it is most especially the role of chief executive officer to define the character of the business and to establish the corporate culture. He lectured at DePaul University in Chicago on July 26, 1984. And I profited from his lecture greatly. He said, first of all, that the way religion can be brought into institution is, first of all, to try to develop what he calls corporate conscience. All of us have personal conscience, telling us this is right, this is wrong. But there is a way of developing corporate conscience. That is, a feeling that institution can do or cannot do, should do or should not do. This is not like my institution to engage in this job or that job. And he says that first step in developing corporate conscience is to make policies. He says we should never begin with values. We should begin with policies. And it was very, very small corporation. We know where Ameritech is now. And he says we started outlining policies with first question, and that is question of identity. Who is Ameritech? If Ameritech became a person, what kind of temperament would it be? What kind of personality? Every institution has a personality. And he says our first concern was to develop the feeling of corporate unity, of identity, corporate identity. Secondly, he says the goals. The goals were defined. And finally, job description. So that policy was in line with vision of identity, with goals, and with job description. The second thing he said is, then we should talk about values. Then we should talk about values. Values should not be first. Values should be second. Values are there to justify policies and standards. And one of our problems in Adventist Church was that we did not answer the question for church standards. And Ellen White tells us that behind every command, there is a promise. Values justify standards. And he mentions several of the values that he considered important. Let me just briefly enumerate. Dignity. Dignity of individual. Every member of my institution will be treated with dignity. Secondly, openness to people's ideas. Communication with ideas. Thirdly, optimum standard of service. We will not accept substandard production. Fourthly, latitude, freedom. Assign the job and then let people use their creativity. Five, leadership through competence, not through some kind of private arrangements. Competent people are leaders, and so on. Second thing he suggests is education. And there he tries to argue again in favor of standards. He says, Christian view of standards is that what is good is in harmony with human nature. So when I say, or when God says, do not commit adultery, reason why God says, do not steal, do not lie, is because to do those things is less than human. When I do it, I act in a subhuman manner. Sin is not legitimate in my life. It is a parasite. We must not give right to sin to exist in us. But that's a theological issue. However, standards are very necessary. Now, the way I explain that is that standards which God gave are the commands. And Ellen White tells us that they are transcript of God's character. He did not arbitrarily invent standards. But he told us what is good that corresponds to his nature. He also told me that I correspond to his nature because I'm in his image. Therefore, image of his character expressed in standards and my nature, which is in his image as well, match nicely together. So that when I obey, that's the way I am going to regain the image of God. It's not arbitrary. He also says that theonomy must have preeminence over autonomy. Autonomy means self-law. Yes. You can, if you have something now, we can. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to lecture maybe 5-6 more minutes. Then we will have the rest of the time for questions. Right? All right. So, autonomy is to do as I please. And humanism teaches that that's the epitome of maturity. But it is not so. Jean Piaget, Lawrence Kohlberg, consider it as the Jean Piaget as third level of development. But Jean Piaget studied children. It is the age of 12 to about 14, 15, 16. That's the autonomous stage where I am the authority. My parents will not tell me what to do. I know what is good. I'm going to stop if I want to stop, and I'm going to drive the way I want. That is not mature way. Maturity is to recognize that someone else knows better. And he says, when you have that kind of attitude in institution, then there is going to be no problem of cooperation. So, especially if there is theonomy, that is God's law. So that when we do certain things, I very often when I go to my classroom during the my way through the hallway, we stop and we chat, so sometimes I come late to the class. And some other students are late and they say, oh good, I'm not late because teacher is not there. That's not true. It's not true. We are both late. I don't measure time. There is another measurement of what is right and what is wrong. So theonomy is what is important. All right. Another thing that ethicists suggest is difference between exceptions and compromise. Now, these things come. So what is the difference between exception and compromise? Well, there are three main characteristics of exceptions. First of all, exceptions must be unpredictable. If you plan for an exception, that's dangerous. Secondly, exception must be unique. If we generalize exception, it stops being exception, it becomes a rule. See? So exception must be unique. And thirdly, exception must be extraordinary. Extraordinary situation. Not regularly, because then again, it becomes a rule rather than exception. Compromise, the word compromise comes from two words, common promise. When you want to reach compromise, then two parties agree to go part way to meet somewhere and resolve the situation. And very often, compromises is the way to deal with some very difficult issues. Because as I said before, sometimes is the question of between bad and worse, rather than question of good and evil. Now, there are problems with compromises. And first problem with compromise is when only one party agrees to sacrifice, and the other one doesn't budge. That's not a compromise. Secondly, when the other party is manipulated or forced into coming closer. Because that then is really not a compromise. So for example, we compromise when we decide to disobey the Sabbath commandment. Because we agree to adjust certain things without asking God whether He agrees, since Sabbath is His day. So when we deal with compromises, we must be very careful. Finally, standards are above values. Let me just say that values are very dangerous things, very slippery things. Very slippery. First of all, there are many different values. Aesthetic values are not necessarily economic values. And yet, some aesthetic values are economically very high. Mona Lisa is very expensive. Real value is maybe what? The value of the frame and the value of canvas and the value of paint that is on it. Real economic value, not much. But because of its beauty, the economic value is very high. I saw it, and you have guards there standing, and it is encased in plexiglass. So, Values are dangerous. In fact, values are used for temptation. Values are used for temptation. That's what we do when we catch fish. We use values. We take the hook, we tie it up to transparent nylon line so that the fish doesn't see it hanging. All it sees is a healthy perform. And that's value for the fish. The fish catches it and eats it, and there is hook inside. Scripture tells us that this is exactly how the devil functions. Genesis chapter 3 tells us that Satan was telling to Eve that eating from the fruit is not only negative value, which God said, if you eat of it, you will die. But serpent says, no, 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 you will not die. There is no negative value. On the contrary, there is positive value. Because if you eat of it, you will become like God, knowing what is good and evil. And then it's very interesting. If you read, you will see how values just follow one after another. Eve made her decision on basis of value. Verse 6 of Genesis chapter 3. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that's value, and that it was delight to the eyes, that's aesthetic value, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, another value, she reached and she ate from it. You must be very careful with values. However, Scripture teaches us that we should put one value on the top of our value system. One value. Which one is it, do you think? Jesus is saying it. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 33. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven. You see, whenever we see something, we evaluate immediately. Paper on the street, we just leave it as a paper. But if that paper is $20 bill, then it jumps the value. See? So whatever we see, whoever we see, we immediately evaluate. If we see a stranger, it's one thing. If we see Falkenberg, is another thing. Immediately. Human beings. But values are important things. We evaluate things. Scripture tells us that on the top of value must be kingdom of heaven. Now, why is it not democracy of heaven? Or anarchy of heaven? Or tyranny of heaven? Why kingdom? What does that mean? God is a king. And what is our relationship to Him? We are His subjects. Which means that His will is sovereign. When I became Canadian citizen, I pledged allegiance to the Queen of England. And if I commit crime, I would be brought to the Queen's bench. That's who draws line. Heaven is not going to be democracy. Heaven is not going to be anarchy. It's going to be kingdom. And when we put the value of kingdom of heaven on the top, other things will come. So that God's will is sovereign. Mount of Blessings, Thoughts from Mount of Blessing, page 76, that Ellen White says, in every command or injunction that God gives, there is a promise, the most positive promise, underlying the command. So promise always underlies the command. So that when God commands something, He commands it because it is good. Some people don't like the fact, I will tell a little story and then you'll have a question. Don't like the fact that God gave commands, especially negative commands. Some theologians even say those are not commands, they should be understood as suggestions. Because God is God of love and He is not going to boss us around. Well, I was pastoring in Montreal and I was repairing my car. My eldest son was about 1.5 years of age. And he was trying to help me. I was under the car. And we lived on a very busy street, the two lanes in each direction. And big trucks were coming, bringing supply to South Shore of Montreal. My wife was inside the house, and I was under the car. And he was playing with my tools, scratching the paint and all kinds of useful stuff. He had a blue ball in one hand. And one moment, I was looking around, I didn't see him. And that's dangerous. When you don't see children, that's dangerous. I immediately looked towards the steep driveway going to the busy street. Very, very steep driveway. And I saw his curls. My wife is inside. He's running. His legs are still not sturdy enough. And the ball will go to the street. What did I do? Well, I followed those theologians. I came to the Mount Sinai and I was concerned with the eardrums of Israel. And I was very kindly saying, Adam, Andre, you know, it would be good if you stop running. Because if you continue running like this, you will run on the street and the car will hit you and you will have a bump on your head. And maybe you will be dead and that would be too bad. No way. No way. I climb on the mount and I shouted, Thou shalt not. I didn't use King James Version though. I bellowed, Andre, stop. He never heard me speak like that. He turned around to see me, tripped over himself, fell, and he's 21 now. There is behind every command, there is a promise underlying it. So, questions? Yes, bribe. This is dangerous, and it's doing a lot of problems to our people. I know it. I have an oldest brother. He was shoemaker and he had big business under communism. He had 15 workers. That's unheard of. But he somehow managed. And then he would come and bring his tax statement. He takes it to the authority. And the person there knew him very well, my brother very well. He looks at it and he says, Michael, why are you doing that? He says, why? Why are you putting the real amount? Well, he says, because that's the amount. He says, but you cannot, you know, we are going to take 75% of your income. You will not be able to survive. And he says, that is going to destroy our economy too. Everybody cheats, Michael. You have to cheat. And he says to this man, I am not going to change the figures. For 25 years, this man changed the figures for my brother. Because this man was the authority, IRS person, equivalent here. And that's how my brother survived. But when the person changed, my brother brought again the same thing. And the next person simply decided not to process it. But my brother was already well known in the city. Now, I visited Soviet Union and Russia. I came just this spring I was there. And bribery was always very strong in communism. I remember one pastor was taking us to Kiev, 14 hours drive from Zaokski, from our school. He proceeded putting two big canisters of gasoline in the trunk. And I said, for goodness sake, don't do that. We have accident, we are burned. Well, he says, but we have to. I say, well, why do you have to carry this? Well, he says, because we cannot buy gasoline. I say, how come? Under gas stations, yes. There is no gasoline. Yes, there is gasoline. Why don't you buy it? Well, he says, you cannot buy it. I say, what do you mean you cannot buy it? Well, he says, okay, let's see it. So we went. And when it was almost empty, we stopped at first gas station. Do you have gasoline? No. How come this man is filling it? That's the last. We go to the next one. Do you have gasoline? No. But how come there are two or three people? That's the last thing I have. So we went to five or six gas stations like this. When we came to the last one, he says, do you have dollar bill? I said, yes. Can you give it to me? I said, yes. Would you mind if we give it to him? I said, well, I don't know. He says, you don't need it that badly. I said, no, you can have it. So we come. Is there gasoline? No. Pump number five. All of a sudden, there is gasoline. So what they do is that I was there, I preached during the weekend. Sunday morning, he says, we have to come to the elder's office, elder's home. Why? He says, you will see, we go to the elder's home, two canisters are full of gasoline again. So then I said, all right. Now, so he cheated so that we can. He says, no, he didn't cheat. But he says, one way, and I remember this very well, one way that we survived under communism is that we had friend baker, friend shoemaker, friend mechanic, friend that supplies coal and wood for winter, friends everywhere who are going to give you at a cost. You do not have to pay. So that most of the time when you have to bribe is because you have no friends. And if you are in different city, and you're not Seventh-day Adventist, so you do not have family, Adventist family members, no one will help you. You have to do it. One person said, well, you Americans, you pay taxes. This is just another tax. But I must tell you, after 74 years under communism, they don't like it. It's not right. They know it's not right. Which only shows that morality deals with the essential nature of human being. It's not good for us to do what is not moral.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.